We've got our yellow legal pad.
And we're broadcasting.
Okay.
And we're live.
Okay. Well, good morning. This is Julie Fedorchak with the North Dakota Public Service Commission. We are gathered on the 12th floor of the State Capitol for a work session. It's 9 a.m. on January 26th, and this is a work session on FERC RP15-1022, Alliance Pipeline Intervention. Brian, are you on the phone?
Yes, Madam Chair, I am.
Welcome. Thank you for calling in. Appreciate that. And we have Randy Christman in the hearing room as well as Jack Hsu. So I think for the format of the work session this morning, before we do opening comments, I thought I'd just we have some folks from both companies in the room here, and we had at one point had thought about having this be a meeting with everybody at the table, but that's been, I think some of the players preferred not to talk, and so how it is set up as a work session, so it's just really our opportunity to talk about this case together with Jack, and Alana is in the room as well, and so I think that's how we'll proceed with that understanding. We have never had an opportunity to talk about this, so it's a good chance for us to kind of talk about some of the issues, get a better understanding firsthand, and also kind of share where we're at if you guys have thoughts on that. So in terms of background for myself, I have been following this issue for quite a long time, but going back to when the state first announced its intentions to target the growth of this petrochemical industry through a pretty significant study that the Commerce Department initiated and identified that we have all the makings for a good petrochemical industry in North Dakota. It really is an important step to diversifying our energy economy and really adding value to some of the products that are produced here rather than shipping them out of state like we did for years with our egg products. And so then when the Badlands project was announced, I think I went to that announcement. I know I did. I think that all three of us were down there, but I don't remember for sure. And then I had some conversations with the Badlands folks, going back a year, maybe a year and a half ago, about some of the challenges they were having with securing ethane in state. And so I had a number of back and forths with them and didn't really see either an opportunity or a venue for any formal action for the commission in that regard until this FERC tariff came up. And then it wasn't even apparent really what a role the PSC might have. But we did file back in December and just a general intervention, which I'm sure you guys have seen. We did vote on this in a meeting in December, but it was just to intervene as the interests appear, basically, just so we could be kind of on top of this issue and be watching it. So that's kind of where we're at now. I think we need to go to, what sorts of steps we're going to take next. And before I proceed anymore, I just wanted to provide that kind of background for you and Randy, since we have never talked about it and I've never shared sort of how I've been tracking this over the course of the last year or so. So with that, I'll just hand it over to Randy for any opening comments, and then you, Brian, and then we can go into the heart of the matter.
I don't have any opening comments, but I do have two questions, so I'll just hold off on those for a moment. Okay. So did I understand correctly that it's your intention that we will not be taking information or asking questions of any of the companies involved today? Is that correct?
That's correct.
And does that also go for any other people who might be possible experts that are in the room?
I guess I'm open if we want to. Are you talking about like Justin Kringstad, who just walked in?
He certainly is an expert on of pipeline-related things.
I'm fine with that if you are, Brian.
Well, whatever you desire, Madam Chair, I'm just here to listen. I have a couple comments when time is right, too.
Okay.
Okay, I will, if it's all right with you, and if Mr. Kringstad is willing, I would have a few questions for him later
as we go. Yeah. Okay, very well. Okay, Brian, any initial thoughts?
Yes, Madam Chair. The one thing, I'll just throw out all my thoughts early, because when you're on the phone, sometimes it's hard to chime in. You pointed out I'm not there today. I'm actually down in Oklahoma City. Victor and I were here with a Southwest Power Pool meeting. And it's funny because the work session today we're talking about is FERC and pipelines, and I spent a lot of time with the FERC on power lines. And we've intervened in some cases, and we're still in the middle of a lot of this discussion back and forth about what is the state's role in some of these discussions. And one thing I'll share with my colleagues is that when we think about the process of a FERC ALJ, I've been out in some of those meetings, and it's a very free-flowing process. So the ALJs out there seem like they're more of a trying to get people to some kind of consensus, and so if it does go to a formal hearing, which I think is one of the backdrops here, the discussion today, that's actually the first step that there's really some formality out there. So the whole ALJ process for the FERC is much different than what we're used to. So that's just something I would throw out there. I guess for me, Julie, I think you set it up perfectly with what we did. We kind of basically got involved because we wanted to see if there was perhaps any interest that may become apparent. And one of the big questions that I have is that what is our true jurisdiction on this? Because my understanding is this is a product coming from Canada through Alliance Pipeline. Alliance doesn't own the products. It's not North Dakota products. I understand that we want to extract those to make plastics, but it's not an unrelated issue where a North Dakota shipper doesn't have access to a pipeline. This is we're trying to extract something off. So one of the big things I would ask our legal team to address is, what is our jurisdiction on this when it comes to this is not a siting case. There's not a pending siting case in front of us. So not that I don't want these plants to go forward, but what is our true role on this? Maybe something that for other folks. And then as all that discussion unfolds, I guess just really see, because the way I understand it is that there's a settlement agreement out there that they want to know our thoughts on it. So I guess for me, I don't know what the latest version of the settlement agreement is. There's some tweaks that I thought that we could maybe that the companies might offer out that make me more inclined to support a settlement agreement. So I don't know how this is all going to flow, but that's kind of basically, I think, Julie, the questions that I would have. And I guess I'll just sit back and listen now.
Okay. Very good. Thanks, Brian. Well, Jack, do you have any thoughts on how you'd like to proceed? Do you want to interject here, or do you want me to? I think one thing to clarify from the start is our jurisdiction, and Jack has looked into some of that. I don't know if you brought the Century Code references with.
I didn't bring it with me. I can quickly pull it up real quick and look if you'd like, though.
Well, I did bring it. Okay. So Alana and Jack have, done the diligence in terms of what our responsibilities are in this area. And so Century Code 4902.16 talks about investigation of interstate rates. The commission shall exercise constant diligence in informing itself of the rates, rules, and practices of common carriers engaged in talks about freight passengers. And then the one that applies to this is there's three areas, the transmission of messages or intelligence, that one not so much, but this one, the transportation by pipeline of crude petroleum, gas, or other petroleum products. From points in this state to points beyond its limits and from points in other states to points in this state and in territory wholly outside of the state. So that's one area where the Century Code says we're supposed to be diligent in informing ourselves of the rates, rules, and practices of common carriers engaged in this. And then 4902.17 says unreasonable rates, rules, and practices affecting interstate commerce. Whenever it shall come to the knowledge of the commission, either from its own investigation or by complaint made to it in any manner whatsoever, that the rates charged by any public utility, including any common carrier in the interstate business, are unjust or unreasonable, or that the rates, rules, or practices of such utility discriminate unjustly against the citizens, industries, or interests of the state, place the citizens, industries, interests of the state at an unreasonable disadvantage as compared with those of other states, or are levied late or otherwise in violation of federal law, rulings, orders, or regulations, the commission immediately shall call such facts to attention of the officials of such public utility and urge them upon the propriety of changing such rates, rules, or practices. So I think that that area is where, in my opinion, Badlands is suggesting that they're being mistreated and have made those claims to myself, and I don't know what you all have heard from them, but so that's the area where I think that that I wanted to be sure that we had any legal authority to engage in, and the Century Code clearly lays that out that we do. So then,
If I could, Madam Chair, though, I mean, that's where it's hard not being there. I think that I wouldn't disagree across what you just read, but that was my opening comments. As long as the agreement at work, if Alliance is willing to take out whether it refers specifically to Aux Sable, there's other people in the state that access. As long as Badlands get the same rates as the different extract points in the state, that's where I think that where the beginning of a reasonable settlement agreement is. And I think the interpretation from legal is, due to the facts of this case as they apply, actually tie in that we do have the solid jurisdiction on it. So it's more than just the law. It's how the facts of this case apply to that law.
Jack, do you have some thoughts on that?
No, we did get into this a little bit late. I don't have a whole lot to say on the matter. And to be quite honest, some of this is still pretty murky. We haven't had the ability to, with our smaller staff, to really follow along for the last 3 or 4 months and probably do any discovery requests along with this. So most of my information comes from the filings. I did flag this last week as something that may be of interest to the state, and that's why essentially we ended up bringing this forward, and that's why at the time I took a position at the FERC meeting, the settlement meeting, because just to allow us the opportunity to sit down and actually have this conversation, decide what actions we did want to take going forward, and what sort of a role the commission would prefer to take in this.
So when you talk about the facts, Brian, I'll throw out what I know the facts to be, and that's, you know, it's a technical, really technical case, but just I'm going to go simple here. Alliance feels like, no, I'll start with Badlands. Badlands is complaining that the FERC tariff, as it lays out, requires the producers who are using the line to ship to sell their gas to Aux Sable and for processing. And they don't think that that's that's fair, and then there's further complication between contracts that exist between Alliance and Aux Sable in Canada for processing that gas that are required somehow through this tariff to be carried through in the U.S. as well. And then Alliance has acknowledged that that they and has offered to take out language in the tariff that so currently the tariff requires that the upstream shipper needs an extraction agreement with Aux Sable, and they're saying they're offering to change that to say that they must have an agreement with a processor. And so I think that addresses one of the Badlands issues, but it doesn't address a contractual issue, so it doesn't change the availability of the product in North Dakota at a reasonable price. And so the question becomes, is it fair? Is what's going on fair and creating a level playing field for folks in North Dakota accessing that? And is that allowable as a common carrier? I mean, that's kind of the question that I come down to, is how this tariff is created and being implemented in a way that is fair and non-discriminatory for North Dakota folks who want to access that product. And so I think that's where that's the clarity that we need to get to figure out our next step.
Well, I certainly appreciate your discussion on that. I would agree with you wholeheartedly. I think that's where the staff really needs to look at what's really going on, because I go back to some of the background in, you know, different rates that appear for shipping for railroad. You'll have different rates and different lines, and you know, that reasonable, just and reasonable, like Alana talked about, it's really hard to measure that. So I go back to what I think, if there's a settlement agreement that comes forward that, like you said, removes the Oxable portion of it, that can show that bad lines will be treated the same as the other extract points in North Dakota, I think that's a settlement agreement I can support. If it comes back and that Badlands is treated differently than other extract points in North Dakota, then I think it's a different position. And I will say, too, that the coal Canadian portion of this, I wonder if how that ties into our jurisdiction, what the Canadian rates are, and back to the facts in North Dakota. I don't know. That seems like different between North Dakota and South Dakota and Minnesota when you start talking about what happens in Canada to how we apply North Dakota law.
Well, and there's some contractual agreements that are initiated in Canada, correct, Jack, that are required to be honored in the North Dakota and all the U.S. states, or some sort of complicated arrangement.
It does get a little bit murky, but at least the way it's been communicated to me, there is some sort of agreements with not Alliance itself, but Alliance Canada, that essentially carries downstream. And I think when we were talking about that proposed tariff, that on its face it seemed discriminatory, and that's kind of really what flagged it, having the Oxable in there. It did alleviate some of my concerns when I saw that they would proposed and brought that forward, that they'd possibly be able to take that out. However, I don't think that actually would fix the paradigm that Badlands is probably currently in with regards to that, because of
the contracts.
Because of the contracts, and even having been required to have a downstream processor, if you think about it, they would have to essentially build a processor without being able to have any products. So, I mean, that's the right. That I guess that's some of the concern of Badlands. The market exposure they would have. But I think that's a lot of the concerns as of right now.
This is exactly why we offered to have this open to everybody, and you guys declined. So we know that we don't have all the facts, and we don't know that this is confusing, and this is exactly why we tried to have this be an open discussion. So, but that was declined, so we're going to have to just barrel through and continue to talk it through on a staff level and get our at least our questions out there, and we can fill in the gaps after the fact.
And that just reminds me of something I was going to point out a while ago before Brian talked, and when you had kind of kicked things off and started getting into the detail, you'd mentioned something to the effect that the facts that we have are, and really I think the key fact that we have is that by this commission's usual definition of facts, which are things that people bring in oftentimes under oath but always on the record and where someone else can challenge it, by using that definition of facts, really the one fact that we have here is that we don't have any facts. And so we have, you know, a fair amount of hearsay that's been built up. However, this is kind of different than all of our other cases in that I think all of our other cases, by law, require us to gather those facts in an evidentiary manner. But in this case, and I don't know of anywhere else that I've ever seen this in the Century Code, this mentions a complaint made to it, us, in any manner whatsoever. And so I thought that was a very odd term in the Century Code. Maybe it's elsewhere, but I don't recall using it before. But I guess this is some manner whatsoever,
right,
that it's basically brought to us with hearsay.
Well, and we aren't the judges on this. were deciding whether, you know, to advance this as a, as and continue intervening on behalf of really a broader state interest.
Although my my understanding from conversations with Jack is that to at least some significant degree, FERC is kind of relying on our judgment for their decision making. So it kind of puts us in something of a judgmental.
Jack, what's your? Can you characterize your impressions from FERC? What you've heard from them on their take on this, and how they view our involvement?
Well, it seems to me from the last couple hearings that I called into that it seems that North Dakota kind of actually has a significant role in this one. I mean, I don't think that it's as easy to move forward, or at least to sever off a portion of this with North Dakota involved and wanting a full settlement on the whole case. And of course, that kind of ends up leaving us kind of as a leverage point to some degree in litigation and expenses and how this gets resolved. At least that's how it seems to be characterized to me.
If I could, Julie, I'll just throw out my background experience with this, the FERC on electricity side. Like I said in my opening comments about, you know, FERC ALJ, it's really freewheeling. The ALJ just sits in there in the front of the room. There's no court reporter or anything, and they just go back and forth, and he or she takes comments. And then I think where we're at right now is basically if the commission doesn't say anything in the settlement agreement, we say we're okay with it, then what will happen is the FERC ALJ will prepare the official paperwork, recommend it to the whole FERC. Unless one of the commissioners really wants to dig in more, they'll probably just approve it and move on. And so then what Badlands will be put in the situation is once the FERC makes their decision, Badlands will have to decide if they want to go in themselves and then appeal the FERC decision. If we go and say we do not support the settlement agreement, then the ALJ will just say, no worries, he'll support it. They'll set up a full hearing, all the official stuff. And then what we'd be asked to do is we'd be asked to come out there and give a full background as why we take the position we're doing. So I think I'd like to let Jack and Lana put together some recommendations and some ideas, because if we say we're okay with the settlement agreement, then it'll be up to Badlands to do it. If we don't, then we need to be ready to prepare a case to support our position and the dollar amounts and the time with that in there, because that's the way I see this laying out. So I don't know what the time frame is on this. That's where I heard once it was tomorrow, and I heard once there was an extension. So that's, I think, a big, big question for us right now is what's the time frame that we have to act?
I don't believe there's actually a set time frame at this point in time, but things are moving very quickly at this point, at least to my knowledge.
Is there a conference tomorrow?
There was a conference set tomorrow. I'm not sure it was rescheduled. I was going to call again today, but I did make it known that I would prefer to have it pushed back to give the commission the opportunity to have a conversation about this in a work session.
Okay. Well, Brian, you said you hit on something earlier that's very similar to how I'm feeling on this issue, and that is the notion of fairness that, you know, that the North Dakota companies or processors should have access to this in as fair a way as any others in other states, and so if we took that approach where, you know, ethane should be available to those who want it in our state at a true market price, and sort of left it general like that, that's our position, do we have to get into the nitty-gritty details about how to make that happen, or, you know, what exactly to be digging up in terms of facts? And I mean, can that something more broad like that, a broad goal that we all agree on, be what we advocate for and lay that out? Or does it have to be specific to what is or isn't in a settlement agreement right now or in?
Well, I think that the general concept that you said would be fair to offer that up, but I would also go back to, like, my experience with rail is that there may be differences in pricing in North Dakota given different situations. So I think what we really have to do is basically, if we say what you just said, I think that's a fair start point. And then what it come down to is see if the two companies get together and they can, you know, there needs to be some changes to the settlement agreement and see what they come up with, and then put that back in front of us, and then we either thumbs up or thumbs down. But I would like to go through the settlement agreement, and I hope that they make changes to it, because we talked about the Aux-Sable portion getting removed, and if they tweak some other language, I think we could maybe do what you're saying. But I think it's back on them now to tweak this a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Or not, and if they don't tweak it, then that's easier to say we don't support it. I mean, if they don't remove the Aux-Sable portion of it, I can't see supporting it at all. If they remove the Aux-Sable portion of it, say any shipper, and they can prove that in general most of the extract rates are the same, I would probably support the settlement agreement, unless there's somewhere that could show me that they weren't being treated the same.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you and I are saying the same thing.
Well, so Jack, does that is with that in mind? The settlement agreement language today, where is that? I mean, is that at FERC? Is there a settlement agreement language that we can see? I mean,
I think I would be able to get hold of that. I know there was a proposed change to the settlement or to the tariff, at least the language that Alliance put forward. And we do have access to that. It did take out the Aux-Sable. That hasn't been approved, of course, so we could make a statement on that. And I don't think Alliance would be opposed to that. However, I do think Badlands would still be opposed to that. That's a little bit of a separate issue.
Current proposal. So then the question becomes, how do we characterize what it is that we are advocating for?
Right.
And I've thrown out a general concept. I don't know if that's specific enough or not. So where can we go with that? How can we get to that next step?
In determining where would we like to go from there?
Yeah.
Where we're at is very general, so it doesn't give me a whole lot of guidance in order to really to what to do. I don't think the language proposed change will probably be a major issue. However, if the concern is Badlands getting access to this, that is going to be something that's going to take quite a bit more investigation into what role we can have in actually specifically moving that forward, if that's what the commission chooses.
So you sense that Aux-Sable would be opposed to language of that would just say, you know, any ethane should be available in North Dakota for those who want it at a market price?
To that language? I'm not sure about that. I would have to actually talk to the parties about that.
Okay.
Before we just make some conclusion with something kind of vague and simple. As long as he's in the room, I'd like to ask Justin a few
good
questions.
Yeah, that would be great.
Mind. I only have three unless there's some follow-ups depending on the answers. So it won't take all day.
Good morning.
Good morning, Justin. Thanks for being here. You know, part of this whole process that, like I say, we've received basically hearsay and for some time already on this subject. And I've heard talk about the, and it's mentioned in the law that you read, about, you know, overall good for North Dakota, North Dakota businesses and such. And one of the things that I've heard discussed was whether this is, would be a benefit besides creating a business, which I think generally we all like to see happen in the state. But besides that, is it a benefit to the state if the ethane is used here, freeing up more space or more capacity, whether it's just by volume or by heat or whatever in the pipelines? And so that's kind of the direction of these questions. So my first question is, are you aware of any companies that have had to require a rolling flaring of gas because of capacity problems?
So there was discussion. I don't know ultimately what ended up happening, but that was proposed with, I believe it was the One Oak system, where because of some capacity issues, that they would have to go to these rolling flaring situations. I don't know if they were able to resolve it before that came up, but that was proposed, and so I don't know the volume impacts of it, but that was a concept during the fall of 2015.
Okay. And do you expect capacity constraints to hinder our ability to capture and use the maximum amounts of recoverable gas in the future? Or do you think the pipeline capacity that we have at this time is capable of carrying everything out, whether we use some here or not?
Well, so when you say the capacity, so I'm assuming you're referring to the interstate pipeline system capacity.
Correct.
Versus processing capacity. Okay. So at this time, because we've got the Northern Border system, which is a 42-inch line, and we've got the Alliance pipeline system coming through, it appears that there would be enough space with where we see production going today. However, it's going to become competitive on a pricing side, particularly with the Northern Border system. Whereas in the long term, as volumes grow from North Dakota, in order to basically push Canadian gas into a different market rather than coming through the Northern Border pipeline system, they'll have to price their gas potentially at a discount in order to access it. So a technical standpoint, physically there should be enough capacity. It's just going to become market conditions as far as accessing that capacity to move North Dakota gas.
But do you think there's enough capacity for both our and Canada's future needs?
Well, so that was kind of the root of that Bentec study we had done a couple of years ago, where their analysis was that yes, that Canadian gas did have other outlet options, but it was going to become pricing competitive for North Dakota gas to continue to get on to the Northern Border system. And so there were some market solutions that were offered. WBI had held an open season for additional export capacity out of North Dakota up to the Viking system in northern Minnesota. That did not get the shipper support that it needed to move forward. So at that time, you know, there wasn't industry support for, at least for that market solution.
Okay.
I need to follow up on that. Tell me how the Canadian gas and North Dakota gas and the pricing and the different avenues, talk about that again, because I didn't follow what you were saying in terms of the markets.
Right. So the question being, okay, so how does, so the Northern Border Pipeline is a 2.4 billion cubic feet per day.
Mm-hmm.
Capacity. From a dry gas standpoint, we don't expect North Dakota to exceed that for that system or that system need. But there's going to be competition to use the Northern Border system. There's going to be Canadian gas looking for markets, and Northern Border would be an option for those folks. Those shippers will be looking for purchasing and selling gas at, you know, buying low and trying to move gas to a higher price market. So that North Dakota gas coming into the system will have to price itself at a point which would incentivize those shippers to buy North Dakota gas and move it on Northern Border versus buying a Canadian MCF of gas to move on Northern Border.
So our gas will have to be, they'll have to discount it to get it on.
But yes, that's the understanding at this point.
Is the Canadian gas cheaper for some reason?
I don't have the specifics right now of what the Canadian gas markets are.
But in general, I mean, is that why we'd have to discount ours?
I don't have that hard data in front of me as far as what the pricing points are, say at Ventura, Iowa versus North Dakota versus up in the Canadian side.
How do you know that we'd have to discount ours then?
That's just reiterating some of the facts that came out of that Bentec.
Okay. Yep. All right. So that's, they found that there'd probably be, have to be discounted. Okay. So how does the Alliance line then play into that?
Well, so the Alliance system, that's a 1.6 billion cubic feet per day, a 36-inch pipeline. That is operates in a different manner, such that it's rich or, for all practical purposes, more of a raw stream of natural gas where it's processed at Aux Sable right now, or any other, I guess that's the discussion right now, if other processors would be allowed to access that gas. North Dakota accesses the Alliance Pipeline, two points, the Prairie Rose Pipeline, and then the Hess-Tioga Lateral. And so I think there's been interest by Alliance to attract more gas to the Alliance pipeline, but so far it's just been those two systems that move North Dakota gas.
Okay. Sorry, Randy. So you had some more questions for Justin.
I don't know the exact terminology, but we're ship. It seems that companies ship dry gas, but add in like as sometimes as much liquids as possible, but it's kind of capped so they don't get beyond a certain BTU rate. Is that
so? On Northern Border in particular, that's one that they have specs downstream as far as what the BTU value, and so that BTU value rises as more ethane or natural gas liquids get mixed in with the methane.
There's a maximum they can have in there, right?
Correct, and it's typically right now driven by market conditions such that ethane prices are so low that there really isn't a value in stripping it out individually, shipping it. So they leave as much ethane in as they can because there's just not a pricing incentive to separate it and ship it on the ethane markets themselves.
But as far as how much someone could conceivably add in of ethane, is that not capped? Because doesn't it drive up the BTU rate of the gas?
Correct. So there would be a theoretical limit. You know, if Northern Border can move 2.4 billion cubic feet of gas and the downstream markets say we don't want our BTU value above X number, then mathematically, yeah, there would be a theoretical limit to how much liquids content could be in that stream.
And by the way, this is all one question, you know. So, so when because of the value of it, and probably I suppose the value of it is determined by the fact that there's really no use for it here as of now, for the ethane. But when that's being mixed into with the dry gas and shipped out, does that mean that mineral owners are not realizing as much value out of their gas as they would if it was separated and used for something here and purchased by someone?
I don't know if I've got a great answer for how that relationship. Obviously, the mineral owner wants the highest price for those liquids. Right now, the ethane, the market is such that it's most advantageous to leave it in with the methane because you don't require any additional processing fees or transportation of the pure ethane. So that may be the best market solution right now is leaving it in. So it's kind of a, because there is no necessary market in North Dakota, probably the best market is leaving it in because of the current pricing environment.
But if the market were here and the price were similar to what it is in Chicago or where's the place in Kansas where One Out goes, would that be an amount greater than what the value or the cost of taking it out should be that it would actually add value to mineral owners?
That I don't know. That it's going to depend on what the market price is for the ethane. You know, again, the producer of that ethane, the royalty owner, they're all going to be on the same page. They want the most value for that. And so if there's a market in North Dakota that can offer a better price than putting it on a pipeline and selling it in the dry gas stream, I think, yeah, that would benefit the mineral owner.
Okay. Thank you.
One more question triggered by Randy's questions. But if the ethane price is so low that it's of no value to strip it off, right, and you're just kind of pushing it into the gas stream to move it out, why would it be a challenge for a company to get access to that ethane here? It seems like somebody would want to be selling it to a company like Badlands or anybody else who wants to process it here in North Dakota. That's why I'm befuddled by this. We've heard for a couple of years about all this ethane that we have, and it's been almost in some instances described as a nuisance. So we have a company that wants to use it here in North Dakota. I don't understand why it's so hard to get it. Do you have any insight into that?
I don't know what those conversations have looked like between the producers of the ethane and the end processors or users of it, so I don't know what if it's a pricing, if it's a logistical challenge, physically, you know, right now the plants, there's really only two major hubs that can strip ethane, that being the Hess-Tioga facility, and then the state line, the One Oak State Line plants will be stripping ethane coming up later this year. Those two plants will be shipping their ethane on the Vantage pipeline system going north into Canada. I think physically for other ethane to be stripped out at some of the other larger processing hubs, that would require some more infrastructure to de-ethanize the gas mm-hmm. stream. Because right now it's either the dry gas stream or the Y-grade stream that comes out of these plants. And so there really isn't a third avenue today. But again, if there's a market solution, someone that wants that gas, that ethane, that would need to take place in order to physically remove that ethane and use it here. But as far as the conversations, those are private negotiations. I don't have any insight on that.
Well, and I think that's the challenge, and because there are private negotiations that go on and contracts that are signed, I don't have any desire to get in the middle of that as long as those things are being done in a fair way. And so I don't know how we get insert ourselves to find that out other than to just insist in this tariff filing that the parties, that we advocate for something kind of general, like I've suggested, of, you know, that we're okay as long as North Dakota processors have access to this ethane at a fair market price. But I'm totally open to if staff can dig in and find something more specific, or my colleagues have another approach that they take, or have ideas for how to get at what is the fair, a fair position for the PSC in this case. I'm really open to your thoughts on how to get there.
So, Julia, I would throw a couple thoughts that I'd offer up. One thing is that I would offer up, if it's okay with the two of you, that all concerned parties submit a filing to us by next Tuesday as to their position. I mean, you were very gracious asking them to say their piece today. I find it absurd that they're not giving us their position today. So what I would say is I'd offer up them, all parties, 1 week to get a filing to us, what their position is. And I'd also say that when in front of the FERC, it matters when a commissioner goes out there. So just like you guys appointed me for the electricity person, I think that, you know, if you're able to and willing to, you'd kind of be our lead on this, because pipelines is your portfolio, because no matter what happens, I think the commissioners being out there when the time is right makes a big difference. And then we could schedule a work session late next week. We offer up to these groups to give us their position. If they don't, then so be it. But then we're all sitting in the same room after we've had a little bit more time to look at the facts. Then we make a decision, because I still think it goes back to whatever ends up happening, the FERC will make a decision, and Badlands will probably have to appeal it. And so I think that's kind of where this is headed. So I would just offer that up as another possible solution.
I like those ideas, Randy. The only thing I wonder about is the timeline with FERC, but we'll keep an eye on that, I guess.
Well, I'm going to lay out for you what I had thought when I came in here, and because nothing has changed my mind much. And I just want to reiterate some of what you read out of the law and then add to it. And I will point out, instead of reading the whole thing, it kind of becomes so complex because it also goes into telecommunications and everything. I'm leaving parts out and things like that, but I don't think I'm changing the context as it applies to this. So, whenever it shall come to the knowledge of the commission, either from its own investigation or by complaint made to it in any manner whatsoever, that the rates, rules, or practices of any public utility, including any common carrier, discriminate, place any of the citizens' industries or interests of the state at an unreasonable disadvantage, the commission immediately shall call such facts to the attention of the officials with the public utility. That's kind of a shortening of what you had read. The next section, because I'd asked Jack, okay, so we call it to their attention, so then we're done? Because we've certainly done that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the next section, and again, I'm not reading the whole thing, but I think the pertinent parts, whenever discriminatory, unreasonable, or unjust rates, rules, or practices on interstate business are not changed or adjusted, the commission shall take the action necessary in an appropriate proceeding to obtain relief. With that, it seems to me that the law really requires us to probably take some action in this case, although we really don't know all the facts. And so it's going to have to be kind of vague. I think what needs to be done here goes beyond just removing Oxable and replacing it with a processor, mm-hmm. because it still leaves the question whether there's any unfair or discriminatory practices going on. So I think we should be urging FERC to require that available product be made obtainable to any potential user at a fair and reasonable rate. However, I emphasize the word available, and I'm not using that as some legal term. I just put that in. I think we have no evidence to opine on whether or not the product that Alliance is shipping is available or not. And so I think we should also make it clear to FERC that the knowledge needs to be gathered regarding the contracts for the gas in question and whether unfair leverage is used to force shippers to sell to Oxable, and the business relationships between Oxable and Alliance and others to determine whether there is available gas there. I don't know that, and I don't believe, you know, we can have some filings come in, but that still doesn't leave the parties able to question one another under cross-examination or anything like that. We do not have the staff to investigate these contracts and business relationships and things like that. So I think beyond the fact that if there is available gas that's not contracted in a purely separated, you know, between separate companies, and so that it would in fact be available, then I think, yes, it ought to be available to North Dakota purchasers at a fair and reasonable rate, but they're going to have to determine or do some of that fact-finding. I do not know the answers to those things, nor do I expect I will a week from now.
Well, and, I mean, if the companies give us their positions, they're probably going to be similar to what we've all heard. So it's probably going to be a reiteration of the same thing. So are you suggesting that with what you've laid out, that Jack take that to the FERC?
I am, yes, but I am fine waiting a week and seeing if something comes in with filings. If we want to wait a week and see if something changes or if we get something that we really would look at as factual that changes our minds, I'm okay with that too. But I guess I had been under the assumption that we were meeting today with the plan of that we needed to do something by tomorrow, and that admittedly vague response is what I come up with.
Yeah, well, yours is along the same lines of mine, only less vague, so I like it more.
it lays out that this ought to be made available, made obtainable, if it is available. But it still does nothing to figure out. I do not know whether I place myself in the position of a shipper. If I went up, and maybe I'm wrong, I kind of going to be watching Pat over there to see or Alana or Jack, see if I'm completely misunderstanding the concept of common carriers. My understanding would be if I decided to invest and go up there and purchase from someone some gas, and, you know, this is assuming that inter-exchange agreements were in place and things such as that, but I go up and purchase some gas and I want it delivered to Hankinson or anywhere down that line all the way to Chicago where there's an offtake available, that I should be able to purchase it and get it to my endpoint for use. Well, if that's the case, then someone else in between ought not be able to take my gas away from me. I mean, that would be a agreement between me and Alliance in that case that I think should not really be broken. That should be my gas that they're shipping, and it ought to go there. And someone else, I don't see how we can force them to offload to a North Dakota customer someone else's gas that they don't own.
Yeah.
But if it is, if that's not the case, if investigations show that they do control that, then I would look at it differently. So I just don't know the answers to that.
Well, and there's a lot of confusing pieces in this, because you hear about, you know, then gas at some point is available, but yet it costs X number more cents per unit here versus in Chicago or in Kansas, and why is that? Is that fair? What's the justification for that? Why would that be? So,
it seems to me a big part of this has to do with processing rights of it too, especially with that tariff. So Aux Sable is the sole processor right now. They have to, supplier has to have a contract with a processor before they put it in, before they have an agreement with Alliance Pipeline. So, of course, right now, Aux Sable has all the processing rights. Now, I would assume that if Badlands would have access to some of those processing rights, this would pretty much all be solved as it is. However, Aux Sable really has no incentive to do such a thing. On the other hand, if there are any additional suppliers coming onto the market, they would have to use Aux Sable because they're the sole processor right now, the way the tariff would be set up. And I think what Badlands is kind of getting at too, at least when I think about it, is probably that they want to be able to have those processing rights available to them, maybe even before they have this processor built, because of course they're kind of in that catch 22. Build a processor, have no product, and on the other hand, they do have the product, then they could build a processor too, but they need those processing rights at a reasonable rate, I'm assuming.
Well, and my question in all this is, so there was this tariff that provided that Aux Sable got exclusive rights for the processing, and they've agreed to eliminate that, but then there was contracts that were established when that was the tariff requirement, so all those contracts were established under the same conditions that we all kind of acknowledge are not fair, and then so are those contracts still valid? Because those contracts were negotiated for 10 years under the same requirements when they were forced to be with Aux Sable?
They would still be valid. And to be honest, I think even if that tariff, the way they propose it now, were to be back then, those contracts would still be the same, because they would still have to contract for the processor, and the only processor was Aux Sable.
Right.
And so they'd be back to where we were in the beginning with the same.
So to Randy's point, if those contracts are 10 years and they were negotiated even though there was only one carrier, is it right to make them invalid? And that's a good question. So your questions, read again what you want FERC to uncover in this, the second part, the longer.
Well, whether the product that Alliance is shipping is available or not, I don't know if that's a legal term, but it gets back to whether it's under contract or not. And we should make clear to FERC that knowledge needs to be gathered regarding those contracts on the gas and the business relationships between Alliance and Aux Sable and whoever else is involved about the availability of that gas.
I think that is an important fact to get to the bottom of. So we need to know how long we have to wait with FERC, Jack. So if we can get to the bottom of that. Brian, you said a week for them to file their comments. I would say, you know, what is today, Tuesday? Maybe we try to shorten that up a little bit, understanding that this is probably Alon and Jack are talking. Did you?
We could probably move those filing times up even sooner if that's agreeable to what Badlands would be able to get into us by then.
By Friday, maybe.
Even probably by tomorrow.
Oh.
At least from one party standpoint.
I don't know. I think both parties need to have the same consideration about what's a fair time.
Of course. Of course.
Well, I think whatever we decide the time frame is certainly fine, Julie. I just threw that out there as a date, and I really like the line of discussion that Randy opened up. I mean, I think the three of us, I think, are kind of saying the same thing. So if we have to respond quickly, I think Jack can encapsulate what we've said and make it happen. But I just think it is vital that the interested parties submit something to us, because we have no idea that what they told the three of us individually is the same. They need to write down on a piece of paper what it is their concerns are. Otherwise, it is all hearsay. At least we have something.
I agree. Both very good ideas. So let's get those filings. What's your sense, Jack? When do we need them?
I think we need them as soon as we can get them. This is coming up pretty fast. And
okay.
Could we bend the rules and just even ask that question? If tomorrow is agreeable to both parties, it should be tomorrow. If Monday is the earliest one side or the other, you know, let's just give them both a chance.
Do you guys have a preference on, or you do want to file anything? And if so, how soon can you do that? We're asking Tony. Go ahead, Tony. Yeah.
My name is Anthony Strackwitting, Jr. I'm an officer of Alliance Pipeline LP in the U.S., the U.S. Pipeline Company. I'm here today to represent that we do not own the gas that we transport. We have no call to title. It's in our FERC file tariff that's on the record. We do not own. Therefore, it's not our call on who takes that gas where. We have two interconnects in North
Carolina. Do you want to file something, Tony?
We will file tomorrow
to
the commission, answering your question and putting this on the record.
Perfect.
We've been in negotiations for some period of time on this subject. This should not be a new topic.
Okay, and then how about you guys, Badlands, tomorrow? I mean, you know that we'll be, if we, with or without them, if we have to respond to FERC, we will, with or without them, to meet whatever deadlines may or may not come up. Okay, just know that if we, though, have to respond to FERC by Thursday, we will do so, with or without your filings. So we can't. We'll have to go with what we have as soon as we get it. Okay. All right. So then you'll find out from FERC, and we will may or may not need another work session. I guess I would prefer to have another one just before any official position is stay with FERC once we hear from both the companies and have a little chance to think about this. But again, we have to just keep an eye on that FERC timeline and see what if they can get back to us on a date for their next conference. Okay, so we'll look for the filings by tomorrow, and we'll stay in touch with Jack on next steps in the timeline with FERC. Okay, that concludes the work session on case number FERC RP 15-1022, Alliance Pipeline Intervention. Thank you, everybody, and we will be gathering together here shortly, Brian, for a budget discussion. Do you want to stay on the line, or do you want us to call you back?
You know what? If you could call me back, I'm going to go back to the meeting real quick till you guys call.
Okay, sounds good. It'll be maybe five minutes.
Yep, that's fine.
Okay, bye-bye.